over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of a sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. The time is 5 o'clock, which means it's time for your KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland 5 Center for the Arts, presenting Black Violin Friday, November 16th at Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. More information online at portland5.com. And now, your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, several midterm election races are still in play.
California wildfires killed 5 as they attempted to escape.
And in international news, the Afghan Taliban are in talks in Russia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 9th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Mayor Wheeler's emergency ordinance to restrict Portland protests failed to get a vote at City Hall yesterday afternoon. The mayor quickly substituted a new ordinance, and council voted to at least hear from the assembled stakeholders. As Mayor Wheeler noted in his opening remarks, the divides of our nation are mirrored in this very issue. And indeed, statements by Police Chief Outlaw and Mayor Wheeler on the one hand, and the National Lawyers Guild and Joanne Hardesty on the other, represent remarkably different perspectives. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at City Hall and filed this report.
Mayor Wheeler's so-called free speech zone ordinance was dead on arrival at City Hall yesterday afternoon. Since everyone was already there, council voted to hear testimony on a revised ordinance. Here's Mayor Wheeler introducing the ordinance.
As mayor, it's expected that I will do everything I can to uphold the public safety. We cannot deny the increasing rate of demonstrations and increasing violence. This ordinance seeks to remove violence from demonstrations and preserve the public's right to express speech meaningfully. This ordinance enacts reasonable, content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulations for demonstrations held in the city with the goals of protecting both freedom of expression for demonstrators and the safety of the entire community.
The invited speakers on the yes side included Police Chief Danielle Outlaw.
I've seen some narrative out there flat out stating that Chief Outlaw just wants more power. This is not about me. Me taking this job was not about me. Violent protests are not solely a Chief Outlaw concern or a Mayor Wheeler or Police Commissioner Wheeler concern. In fact, violent clashes between demonstrators in Portland have existed long before the two of us took positions here in Portland. However, once these groups of people who have engaged in past violence come together, we don't know when and where they will engage in fights or assaultive behavior. It can be during a march, in the middle of a large crowd or occur at a place where police cannot readily or easily respond. In addition, there can be challenges in responding to these acts of violence, as it takes a tremendous amount of resources to safely make arrests and control violent crowds.
Those were voices of Mayor Wheeler and Chief Outlaw. Their arguments start with danger and fear and conclude with more police power to preemptively protect property and the Portland brand. On the no side of Wheeler's free speech zone ordinance, Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU was the first to testify.
We have deep concerns about this ordinance being presented as a solution to the challenges we face. And because we have such deep concerns, we urge you to change course and not adopt it. We believe it will lead us down a path of rights violations and costly litigation. As to our specific concerns, we have constitutional concerns and concerns as a matter of policy. At the outset, we are hard-pressed to see how this will actually prevent violence from occurring or reduce the use of law enforcement resources and police enforcement. It's also hard to understand how the ordinance that gives government additional authority to enforce new rules is somehow going to lead to reduced enforcement. It really is just creating another avenue for enforcement. We understand that the city's attorney's office believes the ordinance is constitutional, but we respectfully disagree. The problem is we can't just say that reasonable, content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulations are constitutional and end our analysis there. With these kinds of regulations, the devil is in the details, and those details are incredibly problematic here.
That was Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU. Neutral enforcement of Wheeler's proposed ordinance would be difficult given the problematic history of Portland police prejudice. Beth Wooter of the National Lawyers Guild has experience on the ground at Portland protests and offered a sharper critique of Wheeler's proposal.
We understand the desire to stop right-wing violence brought to our city by Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. However, we view this ordinance as exactly what Patriot Prayer wants, an opportunity to enlarge the police state that has repeatedly attacked counter-demonstrators of their rallies. This ordinance does three things. One, it allows the city to arbitrarily place individuals into ill-defined groups. It polices the language of protest to craft what will undoubtedly be overreaching protest restriction. And it enables post hoc justifications for police violence against protesters. Generally, it is true that time, place, manner restrictions are valid exercises of state power per the First Amendment. However, when police are left to enforce these restrictions, counter-demonstrators get hurt. We and so many others have observed this. PPB chooses to send us all they've got. They line up, predominantly facing the counter-demonstrators, and separate the factions. Sometimes with no provocation, the police violently disperse the counter-demonstrators. Most recently on August 4th, counter-demonstrators nearly got killed by police weapons and tactics. We refute many of the factual conclusions made by the ordinance describing these protests. No one but police deploy flashbang grenades, full-strength pepper spray, pepper ball projectiles, and other impact weapons that amount to use of deadly force.
That was Beth Wooter of the National Lawyers Guild. Mayor Wheeler's ordinance is playing into the hands of white nationalists, and the Portland police are the greatest purveyors of street violence. The final invited presenter on the no side was Portland Commissioner-elect Joanne Hardesty.
The police have been a tool of brutalizing people standing up for their civil rights. We are a city known for protests. We are known for making space for people to protest what they want to protest. It is our right as Americans. It is our obligation to stand up against hate. Because if the brave children and men and women had not stood up in the 60s, when people that looked like me were just trying to register to vote, trying to get decent housing, trying to get decent education, if we had not stood up, just because that was the law at the time, it was not a just law. I want to encourage you to slow down this ordinance, and let's have some community meetings in January when I join you, so that we can talk to the community about how we keep everybody safe. It's important for you to understand that we don't all experience the police the same way. When white women protest, the police come out with cameras, and pussy hats and smiles. When African Americans and other people of color and people with less power protest, they'd come out in full riot gear.
That was Portland Commissioner-elect Joanne Hardesty. Their personal experience speaks to the impossibility of so-called content-neutral enforcement. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Joanne Hardesty, former state legislature and NAACP Portland branch president, was elected Tuesday as the first ever woman of color on Portland City Council. The race was bound to be historic regardless of the victor. In the end, Hardesty won with a 62% of the vote in Multnomah County Commissioner and Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, 37%. Hardesty's 25% lead echoed the outcome of the spring primary when Hardesty got 46% of the vote to Smith's 21%.
Three fast-moving wildfires are still burning out of control in California, destroying homes and forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate. Five people died in Northern California when flames engulfed their vehicles as they attempted to flee Paradise, a mountain town north of Sacramento. Many people were forced to abandon their vehicles and run for their lives down the town's sole road. The blaze that broke out on Thursday has more than tripled in size to 70,000 acres and is only 5% contained. Scott McLean of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, said the town of Paradise had been, quote, devastated. About 2,000 structures were destroyed in the area. Nearly 500 miles to the south, a second fire forced the evacuation of the upscale Oceanside city of Malibu and threatened the beleaguered town of Thousand Oaks, where 12 people were killed this week in a shooting at a bar and dance hall. A third wildfire was also expanding in Southern California's Ventura County. No fatalities have been reported from the two fires in the south. California Acting Governor Gavin Newsom on Friday declared a state of emergency for areas affected by the Woolsey and the Hill fires in Ventura and Los Angeles counties.
2 days after the midterm elections, some important contests are still pending. In a near repeat of the so-called Brooks Brothers riot that helped steal the 2000 presidential election from Al Gore, Republican-backed protesters have descended upon the elections offices in Broward County, Florida, to prevent an effective count of the remaining ballots in the midterm senatorial contest. Both the governor's office and a Senate seat are still in play in Florida. Republicans who are appearing slightly ahead for both seats are watching their margin erode as absentee ballots, which favor Democrats, are slowly counted. Nationally, the president is furiously tweeting in all caps as ballots are counted in populous Palm Beach County, and the Republicans have sued the election supervisor there, fearing a loss. In Georgia, Democrat Stacey Abrams has refused to concede her gubernatorial contest against the Republican candidate Brian Kemp. Kemp is accused by observers of skewing the results of the race as he held the state elections chair even as he was running for governor. Greg Palast, quoted in The Salon, said, quote, "The hidden story here in Georgia is the fight over the provisional ballots, something that didn't even exist until after the election was stolen in Florida in 2000. The provisional ballots are given to you if your name is missing from voter rolls or there is an ID problem or something else that doesn't meet Georgia or any of Mr. Kemp's chutes and ladders requirements to vote. You voted provisionally," end quote. "Now that you fill out the provisional ballot," Palast continued, "it's put in this orange envelope that looks like it's from Biohazard. They decide where they vote, where that vote will be counted." Palast points out that Kemp never intended to count the provisional ballots, using them instead as a placebo to make people think that they had voted when they effectively had not. "We've already been told," Palast said, "Brian Kemp has laid down the law to all the counties. You are not to count provisional ballots of anyone who has been purged, even if they have been purged wrongly. Now we have, as we know, 340,140 people purged from moving who didn't move." As of earlier today, Arizona's Democratic Representative Kyrsten Sinema was still ahead of Republican Representative Martha McSally by a mere 2,000 votes. In Florida, Republican Governor Rick Scott leads Democrat incumbent Senator Bill Nelson by about 15,000 votes and dropping for the Senate seat, Representative Ron DeSantis, a Republican whom the Associated Press declared the winner is ahead of Democrat Andrew Gillum by about 35,000 votes and dropping in the Florida governor's race. Meanwhile, Republican Brian Kemp is ahead of the Democrat former State House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams by 63,000 votes in the Georgia's governor's race, but Abrams continues to make substantial gains as the purged votes are gradually counted.
And in another election story from Georgia, on Tuesday, voters elected a woman of color who's also a Democrat in the traditionally Republican area once represented by Congressman Newt Gingrich. Lucy McBath is a gun control and racial justice activist. Her run was inspired after her son died in a 2012 shooting. McBath beat the Republican currently holding the job, Karen Handel. Just last year, Handel won a special election for the Georgia district. The AP officially called the race for McBath on Thursday. She had a lead of almost 3,000 votes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's temperature will drop to 40 degrees in the Portland metropolitan area. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high near 53. Today is the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht, a pogrom against Jews throughout Nazi Germany on the 9th and 10th of November 1938. It was carried out by Nazi paramilitaries and German civilians. The German police looked on without intervening. The name Kristallnacht comes from the shards of broken glass that littered the streets after the windows of Jewish-owned stores, buildings, and homes and synagogues were smashed. The quote of the day is from Elie Wiesel, who said, quote, "We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An incumbent state representative in Wyoming lost his House seat against Northern Arapaho member Andrea Clifford. Clifford credits much of her win to meeting people in person and creating a strong social media campaign. Melody Edwards has more.
Clifford is the former assistant manager of the Wind River Casino and a former county commissioner. She says 65% of her county is Native American, but they aren't usually empowered to vote, and she worked hard to educate people about where and how to cast their ballot. Clifford says social media was an important tool to do that.
Native people were into social media. It's like our newest, latest technology of the moccasin telegraph. And number one being Facebook. So you'll see a lot of my Facebook posts, what I capitalized on.
Clifford says her slogan, "Indigenous Women Strong," resonated powerfully all around Indian country. She says now that she's won, there's a lot of work to do.
We need a Native at the tables in Cheyenne. It's important to have our voice. We're a large land-based tribe, you know, 2.2 million acres. We have a lot of potential for economic development, for collaborating and partnering.
Clifford will be the second Native American woman to serve a statewide office in Wyoming. The first was Senator Afi Ellis, a member of the Navajo tribe. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards.
9 Native Americans were elected to the Montana State Legislature. Nikki Willett of Montana Public Radio reports.
Tribal members held 9 seats across Montana's House and Senate during the 2017 session. This session, they'll hold 11. While 4 tribal members ran unopposed for Senate and House seats, in 2 races, tribal members from different parties ran against each other. Democrat Jonathan Windy Boy of the Chippewa Cree beat out fellow Chippewa Cree Republican Bruce Myers. Tyson Running Wolf, a Blackfeet Democrat, also beat out fellow Blackfeet Republican Kay Webb Galbraith in Tuesday's midterms. 17 Native Americans ran in Montana's primaries, according to Mark Trahant with Indian Country Today. 14 made it to the general election. The Montana Indian Caucus has previously lobbied for Medicaid expansion and tribal water compacts. With 8 House members and 3 senators, Native Americans will make up 7% of the Montana legislature this January. A census estimate for 2017 says American Indians make up 6.7% of Montana's total population. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
In Idaho, Paulette Jordan may have been defeated in her race for governor, but she remains optimistic after voters approved a proposition to expand Medicaid, as Steve Jackson reports.
Paulette Jordan lost by a wide margin, gaining just under 38% of the vote in her bid to be the first female and Native American governor of Idaho. But on election night, she was excited by the prospect that Idaho voters managed to do what Idaho lawmakers have refused to do for several years, expand the Medicaid coverage in the state to cover more people that don't make enough to qualify for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act.
I know that when people see that Medicaid expansion will be a major plus on multiple fronts, from not only health care but mental health and bringing our resources back, they will see that we can expand in those areas where we need to build up on our rural hospitals as an economic engine and expand to rehabilitative health care.
It's estimated that 62,000 Idahoans are in the so-called Medicaid gap, that made too much to qualify for Medicaid and too little to get tax credits under the ACA. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
Support by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, 36 culturally based open door colleges created by and for American Indians, low cost tuition for certificate programs to master degree programs. Info at aihec.org. Support provided by BNSF Railway. BNSF is proud to be a gold-level memorial donor for the creation of the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. More at americanindian.si.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The leadership of the Afghan Taliban resistance are in Russia to investigate possible peace talks with the United States. They are there at the invitation of the Russians, who are hoping to reinitiate peace talks 17 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, after falsely blaming the government there for the 9/11 attacks on U.S. soil. The possible talks come after a dramatic march across Afghanistan by Afghan citizens weary of the invasion and the war. It is the first time in years that the Taliban have appeared in the same room with officials from the U.S.-supported Kabul government, and with the U.S. also in attendance. Afghan High Peace Council delegates, which do not represent either party, were also present. The Taliban officials stressed they would only engage in direct talks with the United States when China, Pakistan, Iran, India, and Central Asian states have also sent delegates to the meeting.
Now that Louisiana has overturned its non-unanimous jury law, Oregon is left as the only state in the nation that still allows non-unanimous juries to convict people of felonies. In conjunction with the KABU Evening News and the Oregon News Service, Aiden Moyer has more.
With Tuesday's elections now in the books, Oregon has become the only state in the country that allows non-unanimous juries in felony trials. Voters in Louisiana have passed an amendment banning the law that originated in the Jim Crow era, allowing convictions even when one or two jurors disagree. Nicole Lewis, a reporter with the criminal justice-focused news outlet The Marshall Project, says a felony conviction often sends a person to prison for a long time, and so the bar for proving someone guilty is beyond a reasonable doubt should be set high enough that everyone on the jury agrees.
To have a split jury, it basically renders that perspective or that opinion totally null and obsolete. Whereas in many other states with unanimous juries, it could result in a hung jury and you would get a retrial and just more opportunity to present a solid case.
This year, two people in Oregon have been exonerated after being convicted by a non-unanimous jury. Unlike in Louisiana before it banned its law, however, a unanimous decision is still required in murder cases. Lewis says Oregon's law allowing non-unanimous decisions originally was passed in 1934 after a trial in which one juror kept a Jewish man from being convicted of murder. He was instead convicted of manslaughter. The trial unleashed anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant sentiments and paved the way for the law. But Lewis notes the exoneration of two men this year has put momentum behind changing this law.
It's possible that just like in Louisiana, residents will take it upon themselves and say, well, if Louisiana did it, we could also try to get this issue on the 2020 ballot and have our chance to say whether or not we believe the practice of having non-unanimous juries should be continued.
Last month, the Oregon Court of Appeals heard arguments contesting split decision cases. State lawmakers expect the law to come up in the 2019 legislative session. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Aiden Moyer.
On Friday, the U.S. President signed a proclamation suspending entry at the U.S. southern border for 90 days. Critics say the proclamation is another attempt to discourage the Honduran caravan carrying asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants from continuing towards the United States. Currently, the caravan is in Mexico. To provide aid for the thousands of migrants, the government in Mexico City converted a local stadium into a functioning refugee camp with medics, food, and other donated supplies. Some members of the caravan and human rights advocates, like the ACLU, have already taken measures against the U.S. government by filing a lawsuit claiming the president, quote, continues to abuse the law, including constitutional rights, to deter Central Americans from exercising their lawful right to seek asylum in the United States, end quote. The U.S. president has repeatedly threatened to close the U.S. southern border, to cut off funding to Mexico, and most recently has threatened to scrap the new free trade agreement with Mexico, which would further destabilize Mexico's economy. Honduran refugees are escaping rampant violence, corrupt government officials, blackmail by gangs and police, and by blackmail by gangs and police. Central American nations have some of the world's highest homicide rates and lowest employment and education rates.
$15 million in Qatari cash was paid to Palestinian civil servants on Friday to cover their unpaid wages. The bailout is a partial response to the weekly Palestinian protests at the Gaza-Israel border against the Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, poor living conditions caused by war and a trade blockade, and the protests are also a call for the Palestinian right of return to ancestral land. The Israeli military has killed approximately 200 Palestinians since protests began in March. On Friday morning, Palestinian civil servants gathered at designated post offices and Hamas-affiliated banks to receive the promised cash in lump sums, which was supposed to cover 60% of their unpaid wages.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 9th, 2018. Here are the main points again. California wildfires kill five. The midterm election results are still pending in Georgia and Florida. And the Taliban are talking in Russia. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Tammy Habietas, Lucas Campbell, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the greatest issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to 350 PDX and Stop Frack Gas PDX about the Portland Business Alliance and their opposition to good environmental policy. At 11, Health Watch brings you information to make you healthier. And at 11:30, Making Contact travels to Puerto Rico to focus on the quiet revolution that's grown out of resistance to austerity. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
And good night to you.
You are tuned into KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is Counterspin. But first, we'd like to thank all of you who are our members and are supporting your evening news and your community radio station. Not a member? Guess what? You don't have to wait till our next drive. You can just go online to kboo.fm and click on that FM or on that donate button right at the top of our page and become an active listener, become an active member of your community radio station today. And guess what, Counterspin fans? It's your time.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Safia Wazir fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan as a child and lived in a refugee camp in Uzbekistan for 10 years. As of Tuesday, she's in the state legislature of New Hampshire. Ilhan Omar left Somalia when she was 8 and lived for years in a refugee camp in Kenya before coming to the U.S. She's now an elected congressperson from Minnesota. U.S. government changed last Tuesday. The House added its youngest woman, New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and two Native American women, Deb Haaland and Sharice Davids, two Muslim women, Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the first Latinas from Texas, Sylvia Garcia and Veronica Escobar, and the first lesbian